sahbazruhallah.resid.com, and writer and political commentator Shabir Hassan Ali, who joined us out of Leicester. I've been your host, Behrouz Najaf, and I'll see you next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pariskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم هم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every year. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Hello and a warm welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm your host.
Headlines: a top election official in the U.S. state of Georgia urges President Trump to stop inciting violence with his claims that last month's presidential vote was rigged. A senior U.S. health official warns of an additional 200,000 coronavirus deaths in the country by February amid a surging pandemic. Also coming up, Ethiopia gives the UN access to deliver aid to the northern region of Tigray, where a month of war is believed to have killed thousands of people. Thank you for joining us. Our top story: an election official in the U.S. state of Georgia says President Donald Trump has to stop provoking people to commit potential acts of violence.
It's too much. Yes, fight for every legal vote. Go through your due process. We encourage you. Use your First Amendment. That's fine. Death threats, physical threats, intimidation. It's too much. It's not right. They've lost the moral high ground to claim that it is.
Gabe Sterling added that some state officials have received death threats. Trump has so far refused to concede defeat, saying last month's presidential election was rigged. His campaign has requested a second recount in Georgia, where he narrowly lost to his Democratic rival Joe Biden. Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger said no evidence of widespread fraud had been found to support the president's claims. Now, Trump has called Raffensperger, quote, an enemy of people. The state of Georgia will also hold in January two runoff elections, which will determine who controls the Senate. Political commentator Frank Emsbach says Trump's strategy is to repeat this message again and again, that the election was rigged and he's the leader to save the nation through this crisis.
I think that what he is doing is what is called the big lie. If you say things often enough and you're important enough and it's crazy enough and so out of sync, people begin to believe it. We know this. And once you get to a point like we have, where 40% or more, maybe of the entire population, and 70% of the people who voted for Trump feel the election is illegitimate, feel that the election has been stolen because they've heard it and heard it and heard it, then you have a situation where people take action. They don't have to be told to take action. They believe they're defending the country. And you set up a situation where the country becomes ungovernable and needs a strong leader like Trump. That's what he is after here. I think it's getting clearer and clearer that the strategy is a destructive one for our country. And people in the Republican Party are going to have to stand up for it if we're going to be able to function in the future.
Stocks in the United States continue to be disconnected from the real economy of the American people. November was a record month for Wall Street, even as increased coronavirus lockdowns continue the economic despair of the lower classes. Rami Mazahari has more from Chicago.
The unequal gap between America's rich and poor keeps widening at a record pace. Last month was the best November ever for stocks. Yet across Main Street, a once-in-a-century economic depression is being widely documented. While about half of U.S. retirees do rely on a 401k plan, which includes some stock ownership, the richest 10% of Americans own nearly 90% of all stocks. Since the start of the coronavirus lockdowns, the top 10 U.S. billionaires have now increased their wealth by 42%, or $127 billion. That 8-month increase is greater than the annual GDP of more than 130 nations. As much as the nation's ongoing police brutality problems or current presidential election confusion, economic inequality has been a major driver of this year's unprecedented political protest.
We had to fight for an 8-hour workday, and that involved people dying, violence in the street. For that to happen, and it happened here in Chicago, of all places. The history of unions have been fighting for working people, and not just the people who are in unions, but working people of all historical backgrounds. That means civil rights, that means women's movements, and that also means improving the quality of our lives on an economic basis.
Data this week from the Workers' Union-linked Economic Policy Institute revealed that from 1979 to 2019, the income of the richest 0.1% has risen 345%. Over that same time period, the lower 90% of society has only seen a 26% increase, which is not close to covering the accumulated inflation. Since 1979, so-called trickle-down or neoliberal economics, which prioritizes corporations, slashes the role of government, and neuters the power of workers' unions, has completely dominated the nation's two-party system.
In the neoliberal era, you've had two parties that have been advocates of big business with a very different subtle change on like social ideas and on and how quickly they act on big business. You know, there might be the Democrats might be more subtle of their attacks on working people than the Republicans, but still there, right?
In 2019, the United States had the worst income inequality among not just all very developed nations, but across the entire West, excepting only Bulgaria. The economic catastrophe of 2020 will push the world's richest nation even further down that list. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
We're staying in the United States, which has recorded its highest number of daily coronavirus deaths since April. According to the Johns Hopkins University tally, more than 2,700 Americans lost their lives in 24 hours. The figure brings the country's total fatalities to over 273,000. More than 195,000 new cases were also confirmed in the same period. This is while the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention predicted that the country could see up to 200,000 additional deaths in the next 2 months. CDC officials also announced that they expect two vaccines to be approved by the end of the year, saying either one or both of them will be available by February. Registered nurse Carol Duff says the daily deaths from the COVID-19 outbreak in the U.S. is likely to rise in the coming days because many people are still not wearing masks or practicing social distancing.
Today alone, 2,650 deaths, which would be the equivalent to one 9/11 per day or 26 airline crashes per day. We're seeing this daily. I think that the numbers are going to continue to rise. We have several reasons for this. We still have people who think that COVID is a hoax. We have some states that do not mandate masks. But we still have events that we would call super spreader events, similar to the Sturgis motorcycle rally in August. We have hospitals that are overflowing. We have where we had ICU units that had gone over to COVID-19 patients only and then using additional floors for COVID. That kind of went back to them, you know, just being regular ICU units during the summer with a few COVID patients. Now they are ramping back up again. We are having full ICUs with nothing but COVID-19 patients, most of whom, especially if they end up on a ventilator, will die. We're having a lot of deaths. People are told to not come to the hospital unless they're absolutely cannot breathe.
The coronavirus pandemic is surging across Europe, with several countries on the continent reporting a steep rise in cases and fatalities. Italy reported 684 more deaths, bringing the total tally to over 57,000. It also reported more than 20,000 new infections. The country has so far registered 1.6 million cases. In the UK, official data showed the number of infections and deaths rose by more than 16,000 and nearly 650 respectively. Turkey reported a record high of numbers of fatalities with nearly 193 new deaths. The number of infections went up by over 31,000. Turkey has implemented measures including weekday curfews and weekend lockdowns to curb the virus. Germany has also extended its coronavirus restrictions. Merkel added that the government will keep sporting facilities and restaurants closed until January the 10th as part of the measures. According to the Robert Koch Institute, Germany has so far reported over 1,080,000 coronavirus cases and more than 17,000 deaths. Earlier, we spoke to our Istanbul correspondent, Rashan Saglam, to tell us more about the coronavirus restrictions put in place by the government to curb the spread of the virus in Turkey.
Actually, as you mentioned, Turkey is implementing new coronavirus measures, as stated by the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan on Monday. The measures are a weekly curfew that starts at 9 p.m. and ends at 5 a.m. so that people and workers can go to their jobs normally. And of course, during the weekend, we are facing a total lockdown that starts on Friday at 9 p.m. and ends Monday at 5 a.m. Of course, after that, just today, the municipality of Istanbul announced that starting tomorrow, the famous Istiklal Street that is usually hosts daily the number of 3 million tourists and citizens, it will only host or be able to receive 7,000 people. The municipality said that this will be controlled by drones that actually check how many people are in 1 square meter or in 3 square meters. There should be one person only. So the measures are taking place. People are actually abiding by those measures, because if they do not, they will have to pay a fine of $500, which is more than the minimum wage here in Turkey. So everyone is actually staying at home during the curfew and lockdown hours.
The Ethiopian government has allowed the United Nations to deliver emergency aid to the people in the country's flashpoint northern Tigray region. Under an agreement signed by Ethiopia's peace minister, UN humanitarian personnel and services would have unimpeded, sustained and secure access to Tigray and its surrounding areas. The UN has been warning about a possible humanitarian crisis due to weeks of blockade amid a government military offensive there. The fighting between Federal Army and Tigray People's Liberation Front started on November the 4th. The conflict left hundreds of people dead and thousands displaced, with many fleeing to neighboring Sudan. On Saturday, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed announced the end of military operations, saying federal troops took control of the regional capital, Mekelle. A United Nations envoy says 20,000 foreign forces and mercenaries are in Libya despite a ceasefire and a long-standing arms embargo. The UN Interim Libya Envoy Stephanie Williams called the presence of foreign forces and mercenaries in the country, quote, a shocking violation of Libya's sovereignty. She added that there are 10 military bases in Libya that are either fully or partially occupied by foreign troops. Forces loyal to the UN-recognized government of national accord based in Tripoli and those of strongman Khalifa Haftar in the east formally agreed a ceasefire in October. The deal calls on all mercenaries and armed groups to leave Libyan territory within 90 days. Haftar is supported by Russia, the UAE and Egypt, while pro-GNA forces receive military support from Turkey. Elsewhere, members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries are set to meet with their allies to discuss oil production cuts for another 3 months starting from January. The virtual meeting is scheduled to start at 1300 GMT. It comes after 3 days of inconclusive discussions among the 13 OPEC members. Producers are expected to eventually extend the current output until March if their allies in a wider group called OPEC Plus support the move. In April this year, OPEC agreed to cut production by 7.7 million barrels a day due to diminishing demand amid the coronavirus crisis. Producers are trying to extend the current agreement amid the second wave of the pandemic, but the OPEC Plus, which includes Russia, wants the output to be increased. And in other news, a senior U.S. government official has told CNN that Israel was behind the assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The official was quoted as saying that Fakhrizadeh had been a target for Israelis for a long time. The official, however, declined to give details about whether the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump knew about the attack before it was carried out or provided support. Earlier, the New York Times also cited the U.S. official as saying that Israel was behind the murder. Iran has blamed Israel for the killing, saying the terror attack bore the hallmarks of the regime's spy agency. Fakhrizadeh was assassinated near the capital, Tehran, on Friday. The killing has drawn a slew of condemnations from senior officials from across the world. Writer and anti-war activist Sarah Flanders says it is very likely that Israel was behind the assassination of the senior Iranian scientist, but it would not act without a green light from the United States.
I think it's very likely that Israel is behind this attack, but at the same time, we should note that Israel does not act without the agreement, compliance, enthusiastic support of the U.S. Israel would not dare to. They're absolutely dependent for their very existence, for their political, for their military, for their economic existence on the U.S. So, really, Trump sent the message the week before when he openly called for the bombing of Iran, speculated how to start war with Iran. That was the green light, and without it, Israel could not act.
The European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, has expressed optimism that a recalibrated relationship between the 27-nation bloc and the U.S. may lead to the preservation of the Iran nuclear deal. Political scientists insist that Israel and the US President Donald Trump's administration remain determined to try and prevent this. Jerome Hughes reports.
On Wednesday morning in Brussels, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen chaired a meeting of all 27 EU commissioners. The main item on the agenda was formulating a plan to repair damaged relations with the United States under a Joe Biden presidency. At a press conference following the meeting, we asked if there was fresh optimism in the Commission that the Iran nuclear deal can be saved, despite the best efforts of current US President Donald Trump.
We expect that we can approach these issues in a more coordinated way, in a better partnership.
The same topic was raised by other journalists, but the EU's top diplomat was remaining relatively tight-lipped. During an EU event 24 hours earlier, Josep Borrell was certainly more candid when asked about the assassination in Tehran last Friday of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh.
This was a criminal act.
Expert security analysts are in no doubt that Israel, having had the green light from Washington, was behind the murder. However, many of those who are watching events closely believe efforts to prevent the US from re-engaging with Iran under a Joe Biden presidency will most likely fail.
They have goodwill and good faith. European Union, this is really more optimistic about that.
Without going into any details, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell confirmed he spoke with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif on Tuesday. EU officials are said to be on tenterhooks, hoping that tensions in the Middle East don't boil over before Biden can get into the White House. No doubt all of the aforementioned issues will be discussed in detail in 2 weeks' time on the 16th of December, when representatives from the countries involved in the JCPOA will meet in the Austrian capital, Vienna. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, Decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but thy generosity, and none supports but thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey thee. Worship by which I may deserve thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that thou makest me secure in the places of fear through thy security. And placest me in thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Instead of decrying how millions of women are forced to quit their jobs because of COVID-19, news headlines need to underscore that women, and especially mothers, have been pushed out of the workforce because of the failures on the part of the governments, institutions and workplaces to support them. Second, we must situate the pandemic's disastrous impact on women within the broader context of our contemporary crisis of care. What we are witnessing now is neither as sudden nor unexpected as these reports often imply. For instance, prior to March of 2020, women in the United Kingdom were already more likely to be living in poverty, particularly as they make up the majority of single parents, single elderly people, and those with caring responsibilities, which then limit their time for paid work. Women were also overrepresented in insecure, precarious employment and in the low-paid sectors hardest hit by the coronavirus pandemic, such as the hospitality sector, leisure sector, retail and tourism industry. Thus, when we hear that millions of career women are considering giving up work due to the stress of juggling their jobs with childcare and household chores in lockdown, it is crucial that we remind that before the pandemic, gender inequality in the workplace was rife in most countries. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Catherine Rottenberg and Shani Orgad. The piece is titled Making Headlines, COVID-19 and Gender Inequality. The article has been taken from the website of aljazeera.com. Please stay with us for more of Catherine Rottenberg and Shani Orgad's article. We have repeatedly heard about how COVID-19 disproportionately affects women. While men are more likely to die from the virus, in many other respects women are bearing the brunt of the pandemic's impact. The effect on women have been multiple. Violence against women has increased, with incidents of domestic violence soaring. School closures, overburdened healthcare systems and social distancing measures have significantly increased many women's unpaid care and domestic loads at home, which in turn have made them less able to balance these responsibilities with paid work. More caring work at home has also meant that more women have been forced to scale down or leave the workforce. Simultaneously, women, and particularly women of color, have been sacked or furloughed at a higher rate during the pandemic, stalling their careers and jeopardizing their financial security, and the list goes on and on. Media reports have continuously documented the pandemic's devastating impact on gender equality. An article appearing in The Atlantic reads, "The coronavirus is a disaster for feminism," whilst the Financial Times article queries, "Is the coronavirus taking women back to the 1950s? Such headlines matter because they shape how we think about the issue. And today, more than ever, when people tend to consume news quickly, Often on their phone screens, they are more likely to read the headline and scan the text rather than read word for word. Yet we have become so accustomed to these headlines that we rarely pause and challenge what should in fact be obvious. They get the casualty all wrong. The language use often implies that the pandemic itself is responsible for intensifying inequalities and for eroding women's rights. In fact, blaming COVID-19 for women's deteriorating material, economic, physical, and psychological conditions has three striking effects. First, it deflects accountability for growing inequality, locating it in the pandemic. Take the news headline, "Five Ways Virus Upheaval is Hitting Women in World," or the other subheading, "Just like every emergency, COVID-19 is racist, ageist, and classist." This kind of framing implies that the coronavirus has its own agency. Secondly, blaming the virus produces and reinforces a sense of fatalism, intimating that the massive blow to women, the poor and the vulnerable in society, is inevitable since it has been caused by a natural force beyond our control. Statements like "the pandemic will take women 10 years back" or "the pandemic is destroying women's rights," which have been repeated even in the most progressive media outlets, imply not only that increasing inequality is the pandemic's fault, but that it has also been inevitable. Thirdly, headlines and statements like these create the false impression that before the pandemic, women's conditions were improving apace. They suggest that the pandemic has rapidly reversed decades of steady progress vis-à-vis gender equality, as if prior to March of 2020 there have been few setbacks, let alone retrenchments. This obscures the fact that things were already profoundly unequal before the pandemic struck. To be clear, the intention of many media reports is clearly to highlight the worsening of gender inequality and the urgency of addressing it. Yet, their framing too often diffuses responsibility and reinforces a feeling of inevitability, and this needs to change. Rather than blaming the pandemic, we need reporting, including headlines that clearly identifies the root causes of gender inequality, so that we can apportion responsibility where it truly belongs and mobilize to effect concrete change. The first step is to name the forces responsible for growing inequality. For instance, rather than talking about the pandemic causing the dramatic rise in domestic violence, media statements can identify the lethal dynamic of poverty, women's economic dependence, alongside dominant norms around gender, all of which have been severely aggravated post-COVID-19. While highlighting the lack of appropriate resources for critical services like gender-based violence refuges, helplines, and routine health checks. Instead of decrying how millions of women are forced to quit their jobs because of COVID-19, headlines need to underscore that women, and especially mothers, have been pushed out of the workforce because of the failure on the part of governments, on the part of institutions and workplaces to support them. Secondly, we must situate the pandemic's disastrous impact on women within the broader context of our contemporary crisis of care. What we are witnessing now is neither as sudden nor unexpected as these reports often imply. For instance, prior to March of 2020, women in the United Kingdom were already more likely to be living in poverty, particularly as they make up the majority of single parents, single elderly people, and those with caring responsibilities, which then limit their time for paid work. Women were also overrepresented in insecure, precarious employment and in the low-paid sector of the economy, those sectors hardest hit by the pandemic, such as the hospitality sector, the leisure industry, the retail and tourism industries. Thus, when we hear that millions of career women are considering giving up work due to the stress of juggling their jobs with childcare and household chores in lockdown, it is crucial that we are reminded that before the pandemic, gender inequality in the workplace was rife in most countries. In the United Kingdom, for example, before the pandemic, the gender pay gap was already holding steady at 8.9% for those in full employment, and the gender pay gap was 17.3% for all employees. Finally, we must urgently replace fatalistic sentiments with bold demands and swift action on a mass scale. We have roadmaps to draw on. For instance, the United Kingdom Women's Budget Group has called for a radical transformation of our economy, from one that prioritizes profit over people to one where there are ample resources for high-quality care services so that mothers in wage employment are supported and where living wages and safe working conditions are guaranteed for all. Similarly, the Care Manifesto, published this year, demands that we roll out universal care on all scales of our lives, from our most intimate to the planetary.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Hello, everyone. I'm Saeed Pourreza, your host this hour, our top story. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has warned of a psychological war with a targeted misinformation campaign following the assassination of the country's top nuclear scientist last week. A review of thousands of tweets published following the terror attack has shown that 79% were aimed at spreading disinformation and opposition to a nuclear deal with global powers. The tweets call for all negotiations to end and all IAEA inspectors to be removed from the country. However, an analysis of the accounts revealed 93% of the tweets were sent through unknown accounts set up less than a year ago and operating from outside Iran. According to Zarif, Israel is trying to capitalize on the final days of the Trump presidency, doing all they can to prevent President-elect Joe Biden's administration from lifting sanctions and resuming negotiations with Iran. Several Iranian MPs have signed a statement calling for IAEA inspectors to be expelled as a proportionate and immediate response. Iran's envoy to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, has called on the agency to unequivocally condemn the assassination. So far, UN agencies, the EU, and other Western powers have failed to condemn the killing and have instead called on all sides for calm. Mohsen Abbas is a political commentator joining me now for more on that story. Good to see you, Mohsen. So, an online campaign to use and manipulate last week's assassination. What do you make of it?
Well, it's an absolutely open secret, not a secret at all, that the Israelis have a huge investment, vast investment in cyber warfare capabilities. We know that they've carried those out. It was 10 years ago, the Stuxnet computer virus targeted Iran's nuclear program at that time. It's a peaceful nuclear program, I have to add. And that essentially was the first digital weapon that had been used in that kind of way. And subsequently, we've seen the attacks on the Natanz set up in Iran. We've witnessed this attack through the Bandar Abbas, the port, I think it's called the Shahid Rajai port in Bandar Abbas. Mm-hmm. That was also acknowledged by the Islamic Republic of Iran that a cyber attack had occurred. All of these are evidence of Israel's huge capacity for psychological warfare, cyber warfare, for using algorithms to engineer not only attacks on other nations, but also to engineer color revolution, to try to make political viewpoints in a particular region act in their way. We know they've tried it in Iran, in Iraq. It's still ongoing. They organize this on a regular basis. So what Javad Zarif is saying is not outside the realms of possibility, and I think very, very likely, yes.
All right. And given everything that has happened, they have killed Iranian nuclear scientists before, sabotaging Iran's peaceful nuclear program. There are people inside Iran saying, you know what, we have had enough of this. Let's break away free of nuclear treaties altogether. A lot of frustration. Is that the right course of action? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you can understand that frustration, because what was promised as part of the JCPOA was a loosening of the economic terrorism, the stranglehold. That's got worse since this whole process, if you like, has begun. They were promised a rapprochement in terms of many other areas of trade and general relations with Iran, none of which has been delivered either by the various European members of or were signatories to JCPOA, and let alone the Americans who walked out unilaterally. So you would not blame people in the Islamic Republic of Iran to be skeptical. I mean, we've had Trump killing one of the most, beloved servants of Iran, General Soleimani. We've had them now killing a nuclear scientist. I mean, let's throw it back on the Israelis, who have, let's not forget, a nuclear arsenal of 400 plus. Let's not forget that they have no IAEA inspections or scrutiny. Let's not forget that the Israelis have no accountability, no acting against the non-proliferation treaty. They're not signed up to that. So if their professors, for instance, Professor Israel Dostrovsky or Shaul Horev, some of the historic, if you like, counterparts of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, if they were, if you like, attacked or killed or done away with, what would Israel do? Would they respond in a peaceful manner? I think Iran quite clearly is well within its rights to do whatever it wants. But revenge is often a dish best served cold. And I believe the Islamic Republic of Iran's leadership is wise enough to know when and where Israel will receive its response.
And Mohsen, very briefly, the silence on the part of the international community. You mentioned the Europeans that haven't delivered on their promises under the JCPOA, and no unequivocal condemnation of a blatantly terrorist attack.
Absolutely. The hypocrisy stinks, quite frankly. When the alleged Skripal affair took place, and Russian double agents were supposed to have been killed by Russian spy agencies, according to MI5 and various others. There was never-ending, vitriol against the Russians of all kinds. In fact, 153 Russian diplomats were expelled during that period. They've done it again with one of the Russian, dissidents who's ended up in Poland only recently. So it's double standards. We know that. And they haven't condemned this in unequivocal terms. They're, of course, going to rely on Israel's plausible deniability strategies. So they won't openly admit that they've done it. But there's a lot of nudge, nudge, winking, say no more going on by Benjamin Netanyahu. And that's the cover that the Europeans are going to use. The Americans have stayed silent on it as well. So the fingers all point to them. If the EU and the other major superpowers or the powers in the world continue to allow Israel to get away with this kind of behavior, then, of course, it doesn't bode well for the international peace of this planet. And I think if everybody else started acting in the way this rogue entity does, we'll soon have World War III on our hands.
All right. Mohsen Abbas, political commentator. Mohsen, thank you for coming on. Moving on now. A last-ditch legal attempt to prevent a controversial UK Home Office deportation flight to Jamaica has failed. The case was brought forward by two siblings whose father was on the flight, arguing that the current deportation policy was unlawful because the Home Office had failed to properly assess the best interests of children whose parents were being deported. Permission to further assess the impact on children was denied before the flight, but the case is ongoing. In February, the government deported 17 British residents to Jamaica. The Home Office had planned to make 50 deportations, but the majority were stopped by a Court of Appeals injunction due to access to justice concerns. Well, let's cross over to our correspondent, Richard Sudan, who is outside the UK's Home Office for us. Richard, despite the petitions and the pressure, the government has broken its own equalities law and deported these individuals.
Well, I mean, shambolic, catastrophic, inhumane, and racist is frankly how this latest scandal, let's call it what it is basically being talked about by people. Now, of course, on the one hand, there's been a kind of temporary victory, you could say, of sorts, because we know that in the early hours of this morning, a number of people were pulled off the plane after last-minute reprieves, last-minute legal interventions. But, of course, this really begs the question, why did it take a mass public campaign? We saw a huge outpouring of support for calling for these deportations to be halted. Why did it take that and last-minute interventions from human rights lawyers to get us to this place? And, of course, you know, what mechanisms, what safeguards are going to be put in place to prevent this happening in the future? Of course, none of the recommendations from the previous Windrush scandal have actually been implemented, and now we're seeing the effects very much affect the wider Windrush family, if you like.
And, Richard, not only has the government here not cancel these deportations, there was a lot of pressure also on for Jamaica to accept these returnees. Is Britain throwing its weight around here?
Well, I do think that's how many, many people are interpreting this, Saeed. Of course, there have actually been many Caribbean nations who have voiced their concern, about this whole debacle, not just human rights lawyers, not just those nations, not just a massive petition that amassed hundreds of thousands of signatures. And again, in the face of all of the evidence, all of the recommendations which have been basically ignored, the Home Office almost seemed kind of ideologically determined to push this flight through, were it not for the goodwill of human rights lawyers and activists who have very much been keeping an eye on this and making a lot of noise about it. The situation could have been much worse. But let's be clear, a number of deportations have happened. They have gone ahead. And again, this really begs the question, what's going to happen in the future?
And finally, Richard, let's talk about Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, who is continuing the hostile environment policy, something she's had to apologize for just recently. Where does this leave Britain's immigration policy, especially post-Brexit?
That's a very good question, Saeed. And I think, understandably, there are going to be a number of immigrant communities in the United Kingdom, not necessarily just black communities, but immigrants from all over the spectrum, particularly from within EU countries, who are going to be looking at this latest scandal and wondering if the Home Office can get this so dramatically, catastrophically wrong, having a devastating impact on families, what might be the implications for them if the Home Office also gets many of their statuses wrong in the future.
All right, Richard, it's very cold out there. Get yourself somewhere warm. Richard Sudan, outside the UK, Home Office for us. Richard, thank you. Staying in Europe, the continent's high representative, Josep Borrell, has pledged to use all possible means to continue improving human rights in Bahrain. His statement came in response to a letter by MEPs highlighting the, quote, dire condition of human rights in Bahrain. The kingdom has the highest number of political prisoners in relation to population, and the British government is accused of colluding with the ruling regime by giving it technical assistance and training for its police force.
The last time the EU and Bahrain had dialogue was more than a year ago. The execution penalty, the right to just prosecution, arbitrary detention, torture and ill treatment were discussed. The High Representative has assured MEPs that the issue will be discussed again during the next human rights dialogue slated for the end of autumn 2021. That means another year for Bahrain's political prisoners, many of which are women and children. Human rights groups say arbitrary arrests and torture go on unabated, and if the West takes its eye off the situation for even a moment, many people could be executed without a fair trial.
Waiting until autumn 2021 to engage in talks with Bahrain is absurd, and Europe, although it's paid great lip service in recent years, needs to be much more proactive in the engagement for dialogue. In essence, Christmas has always been used as a time when they use it as a smokescreen to be more active in their persecution. We saw a few years ago that Sheikh Ali Salman was taken at that time.
Mohammad Ramadan and Hussein Ali Musa are two Bahraini pro-democracy activists who have been sentenced to death. They insist they, alongside many others, were tortured into falsely confessing to going against the ruling regime. Westminster is accused of being complicit in torture and suppression in Bahrain and allowing executions to go forward without intervening.
By any objective legal judgment, Mohammed Ramadan and Hussein Musa have not had due process. And why can't the FCO not put its mouth where British money is going and very vigorously obtain for these two men, at least now, a delay of execution and a fair trial?
With clearly documented failures of the SIU investigation into Mohammed and Hussein's torture, will the government now accept that its technical assistance to Bahrain has failed in its aims and objectives?
My Lord, the United Kingdom's technical assistance is kept under regular review and is provided in line with international standards, and let me assure the noble Lord, fully complies with our domestic and international human rights obligations.
That was July 8th of this year. On the 13th of July, Bahrain's highest court upheld their death sentences after the British government refused to intervene in their cases. Since the 2011 Arab uprisings, Bahrain's regime has used maximum force to quash dissent and silence calls for reform. Since 2012, Britain has provided £6.5 million of technical assistance to Bahrain, including training for Bahrain's Ombudsman prisons and its Special Investigations Unit, two institutions which failed to properly investigate the torture of Mr. Ramadan and Mr. Musa. Yanka Rahimi, London.
An update now on the German man suspected of killing at least five people and injuring several others by plowing his car into a pedestrian street in Trier on Tuesday. The city's chief prosecutor says the man was driving while intoxicated. Peter Fritzen told the news conference the 51-year-old suspect had consumed a significant amount of alcohol ahead of the crime and did not, as some had suspected, have any motives for political or religious terrorism. The UK has become the first country in the world to approve the Pfizer-BioNTech coronavirus vaccine, paving the way for future mass vaccinations for UK residents. Health Secretary Matt Hancock has said 800,000 doses of the jab, said to be 95% effective, would be available in the UK from next week. Top of the list of those to be immunized, care home residents and staff, followed by over 80s and health practitioners. Elsewhere in Europe, Italy's Minister of Health has announced his country would be launching a massive free coronavirus vaccination program early next year, with health workers and the elderly to be given priority. In France, President Emmanuel Macron has said the nation would be embarking on a broader COVID-19 vaccination program in the spring of 2021. This after a smaller vaccination campaign takes place in January of next year. Staying with the French president, he has declared his country will not agree to a Brexit trade deal if it does not meet France's long-term interests, particularly those to do with trade and fishing rights. The UK and France have been locked in a bitter battle over post-Brexit fishing rights. The French president aims to maintain EU access to British waters, a demand the UK government is fiercely against. Macron's comments come as Belgian Prime Minister Alexander De Croo said the European Union and Britain were in the last minutes of a football game, quote-unquote, when it came to discussions over Brexit. Britain will officially leave the EU on December 31st. Two stories in this segment. Story one. A few days ago, Israeli soldiers shot and killed a 36-year-old Palestinian man at a checkpoint in East Jerusalem, Al-Quds. The soldiers who did it claimed Nour Shagher, attempted to carry out a car ramming attack. Today, their story unraveled. And Robert Inlakesh joins me now with an update. Robert?
Well, this execution, which took place over a week ago now, has been documented by B'Tselem, which is an Israeli human rights organization, to have been a car ramming that never was. They go through the report. This is a leading human rights organization in the area. Israeli guards from private companies and also Israeli border police pursuing a Palestinian after he had entered a checkpoint in East Jerusalem with what they said was false documents. He tried to flee the scene after he was approached by gunmen. He hit one of them, and then he parked his car up here where you just saw them approaching, and on the way they were firing multiple rounds into his car, and he was killed by the shots which were fired when his car was parked in a position which posed absolutely no threat to Israeli soldiers. Netanyahu has not commented on this. And on top of that as well, the Israelis have even given the body back of Nour to his family.
Guilt, Robert?
Absolutely, because for any people that know what happens in Palestine is that if the Israelis do suspect somebody committed an attack, they condemn them as a terrorist and they keep the bodies of suspected terrorists. They gave the bodies straight back. And they also did not release the video footage from the checkpoint, which is readily available for them to do so. And if they were right, would prove they are in the right. On top of this, we have seen no prosecution of those who pursued and shot him illegally. Extrajudicial execution. There was no reason to execute him. B'Tselem has outlined this. Others have commented on this. And at this time as well, it seems absolutely a possibility Israel, the military, was disagreeing with the police, and that this is a huge cover-up.
An extrajudicial execution, as you say. What has the online reaction been to this story, Robert?
The first we've got here says, just another murder by the IDF thugs that will go unpunished by the criminal state of Israel. The UNHRC will remain silent. And then we have another one here as well that says, imagine if international law were actually humanitarian and the media would pursue all those who are hostile to the Palestinian people and accuse them of being anti-Palestinian.
All right, let's go straight to your second story, Robert. The recent death of the British founder of the White Helmets, the unfolding cover-up at the OPCW, the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons, of an apparently staged chemical weapons incident in the city of Douma, and how some in the mainstream media are trying to whitewash it.
Well, this story focuses in on the specific series called Mayday, which was just released as a podcast series by BBC. I'd actually been listening to it today. And what it attempts to do is to say that a number of activists, journalists, and experts as well were all part of conjuring up crazy anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. They claim that they are anti-Semitic. They focus heavily in on Vanessa Beale specifically in this series. The woman who put it together for the BBC seems like she has a personal vendetta against Vanessa because Vanessa refused to be featured on the program. When you listen to the program, they don't present any real counterpoints to any of the points made, such as that James Lemessurier was perhaps involved in, or his organization, the White Helmets, was involved in organ trafficking, its massive funding from Western intelligence agencies, and the fact that it is a front for multiple militant groups operating in the Takfiri areas held of Syria. So the series in of itself is trying to present anyone that presents or believes in an alternate theory of what's been going on in the war, that the war was conjured up by Western governments in order to take out the secular government of Syria and replace it with Takfiri militant-led states, or what they would attempt to call caliphates. And if you believe that the West was involved in this, even though the footprints are there, which they even note inside of the series, then you're a crazy conspiracy theorist who should be shunned by the world.
And Robert, the truth will out, as they say, and we should hope it will. How has social media reacted to this story?
The first one here we have commenting on this article, which was published in the Gray Zone. They say Aaron Matte, who was the author of the article, takes apart one episode of the BBC's interminable Mayday podcast series, which seeks to exculpate the late James Lemessurier, founder of White Helmets, to demonstrate the complete and utter sham the program is from start to finish. And then we got another one here who says, I've been intermittently hate listening to it. Absolutely awful, outright propaganda. That despicable person who made it tries to play the victim, presenting independent journalists on par with those with state corporate media platforms whose lies are never challenged.
Robert and Lakesh with those stories. Robert, thank you. And that's your broadcast. Goodbye from me and the team here in London.